our scripture reading schedule in that first portion. The first reading, as you find it in your bulletin, continues our journey towards the end of the book of Numbers. And we have before us this coming week, chapters 24 through 30. Recall that we are in that third section of the book of Numbers as the children of Israel make their way to the plains of Moab and eventually to the conquest of the promised land. Last week's schedule concluded with that Gentile or pagan prophet, Balaam, blessing Israel a second time to the great consternation of Balak, the king of Moab. Preparations for a third go of it begin at the close of chapter 23, and chapter 24 has a third blessing from God through Balaam, and then a set of prophecies about Israel's future blessings and victories, and the defeat of their surrounding enemies, the nations round about. At the close of the chapter, Balaam and Balak go their separate ways. However, we find out later that Balaam gave a piece of wicked advice to Balak that led to what happens next. In chapter 25, despite all the glorious blessings pronounced upon Israel from God through Balaam, Israel demonstrates that many still have a wicked and unbelieving heart, lacking grace. As Israel was encamped at the place called Acacia Grove, many began to engage in idolatry and immorality with the women of Moab. We should recognize allusions to the previous incidents of unfaithfulness, going all the way back to the idolatry and immorality at the foot of Mount Sinai. There are threads being drawn showing the persistent unbelief in Israel, the persistent lack of faith, and indeed hard-heartedness in Israel. However, in this case, God does not say to Moses, "Step out of the way so I can destroy this whole people." Rather, there is judgment that comes. God sends a plague of judgment, but he also gives instruction for judgment to be brought by the leadership of Israel. We see things that are in common, tracing all the way back, but also things that have changed as God persists in his plan and will pursue that plan graciously, even in the face of the hard-heartedness of Israel. But again, there are differences here. There are changes. And there are those who rise up and act aggressively, zealously in judgment as God commanded. So there are some changes in this new generation. After the judgment of the plague subsides, a new census is ordered by the Lord. This new numbering is one of those incidences that gives this book its name, as we mentioned before, the name in English, Numbers. But its point here is not only to size up the fighting force, that's mentioned briefly, but more importantly, to set out the relative proportion of the different tribes as preparations are made for allocating the land to those tribes. So preparations are moving forward for the taking of the promised land. It's important to note that the previous generation has passed away. That's mentioned in this passage. Those earlier descendants of Jacob, the children of Israel, who refused to enter the promised land, these have perished in the wilderness, those that were of that certain age and above. And the only ones remaining of the people of Israel, apart from Moses, of course, are Joshua and Caleb. And this was in keeping with what God had promised. This was a long judgment promised by God, and he brought it to pass. Sadly, not all of that next generation had learned from that long and arduous judgment. Chapter 27 begins explaining a series of laws given in the following chapters for the people as they prepare to inherit the promised land. Because the land would have a kind of sacramental significance, special provisions were made to preserve the land inheritance within the families and tribes to which that land would be given as they entered that promised land. That arrangement is described in the first part of chapter 27. What would be done if there was lacking one to inherit the land in an ordinary fashion? How would that land continue as the promise that pictured their possession of grace in God's covenant? Those stipulations are set out here as there are daughters who were left with no men to inherit, and accommodation is made for the land that would have been passed to their father and to the sons if he had had them. Now it will pass to them, and other order is made for that inheritance to be passed on. The remainder of chapter 27 has to do with the succession, not of land, but of leadership. Moses, remember, had sinned gravely, and though he was otherwise immensely faithful and obedient, there was a judgment given his position in leadership, and the example that he set before the people in that disobedience, he would not enter the promised land. And so, with that gracious heart that we've seen displayed in Moses over and over again, he now pleads with God that the people not be left without leadership. And God answers by appointing Joshua. Instructions are given for Joshua's commissioning before the people, and this is carried out in the presence of Aaron's successor, Eleazar, and that before the people. Chapters 28 and 29 give a complete and updated summary of the national ceremonial liturgical calendar of God's appointment for the people, with all the required sacrifices for each holy day to be observed as the people settle in the promised land. These were the public ordinances that were to be shepherded by the Levites and the priests, and these were in addition to all the commands that were given for other kinds of sacrifices that would be brought by individuals on other occasions. And so we see a very elaborate ceremonial system, which is abundantly gracious, but also something that we can understand Peter describing later in the New Testament as very burdensome. There was grace in what was provided to the people for access to God, to maintain the presence of God in their midst. But it was a very elaborate and very burdensome set of requirements that were fulfilled and lifted in the work of Christ. Chapter 30 deals with special cases in relation to vows. And it is important to note that even though vows were a solemn act of worship, they could not be used to overthrow God's established order in the home. And so instructions are given for dealing with the review of vows by superiors when those vows were taken by inferiors. The particulars given is in relation to a daughter or a wife that takes a particular vow, and that is a public act of worship. But because she is under the authority of her husband or her father, this could not be used to overthrow his authority. He was required, the one who was charged by God in God's design and order to maintain the household, it was required of him to review the vow. And he could leave the vow in place, in which case he was required to allow that vow to be fulfilled. But if he found that that vow, in fact, was inappropriate or out of accord with what he would maintain in his household, he could overrule that vow. There is much here of practical use and worthy meditation in considering the implications in many areas of life as God establishes a structured order in his institutions, and what it would mean for someone to exercise some means that would be intended to overthrow that good order. God does not intend for that good order to be overthrown in that way. So this has a reach into many other areas of God's good order, but especially here as it's applied to the home. Good things for us to consider in very practical ways. Now, I wish to read in your hearing that portion of chapter 27 where Joshua is appointed as the next leader of Israel. It is in 27, starting at verse 12 through the end of the chapter. And as we hear, let us be reminded of the sin of Moses and the implications for the calling of leadership. Given the abundance of grace manifest in the life of Moses, we might at first think that this seems extreme. This man who has been so faithful and borne such weight of the burden of the people of God over and over again, he bears their wrath and their complaints, though their real complaint is against God. And he remains faithful over and over again, pleading with God on behalf of this wicked people, hard-hearted people. So he has manifest abundant grace. If anyone has been a magnificent leader of God's people, full of grace, deep with humility, and rich with a love for God and a love for God's people, surely it was Moses. And so we might think, he messed up once, just once. And yet, the call of his leadership before the people to embody the commands of God placed a burden on him that carried great weight. So we must never trifle with any sin, and especially in our positions of leadership, as fathers, as husbands, in the civil sphere, and especially, as it applies directly here, those who lead in God's church. What a great burden of care must be placed on the walk of holiness. This must be taken with great seriousness. Moses must surely have been brokenhearted that he would not be allowed to set foot in that land that he had taken so long to lead the people to. And yet he bears up under that judgment without a word of complaint. What grace is manifest in the life of Moses. So let us have that in mind. Let us also take note of the display of grace in Moses when he might have complained and appealed to God on his own behalf in this situation. What does he do by making an appeal? Is it about himself? Is it about what he wishes he could have? No, again he makes an appeal on behalf of the good of God's people. Please don't leave them without a leader. Please appoint the one who will come after. And God meets that need. Oh, that leadership may be godly in God's church like this. Gracious, selfless, humble, and truly overwhelmingly obedient, but taking personal and great care for a walk of holiness. So with these things in mind, let's stand together and hear this last part of chapter 27 of the book of Numbers. Beginning at verse 12, this is God's very word, holy, infallible, inerrant in all its parts. Let us hear and heed. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Go up into this mount, Abarim, and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people as Aaron, your brother, was gathered. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin." Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd." And the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. set him before Eleazar, the priest, and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of Israel, of the children of Israel, may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of Urim. At this word, they shall go out, and at his word, they shall come in, he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and he laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. You may be seated.